Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is part two of For the Record program number 244, Trouble on Oiled Waters, part five, Line of Succession, Restoring Dignity to the Office of the Presidency. What we're going to take a look at now is an article from the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, July 26th of the year 2000 that we excerpted near the end of part one of For the Record 244. By the way, this being recorded on August 13th of the year 2000. This again from the Wall Street Journal of 7/26/2000, an article by Alexei Barrionuevo. Its headline, Cheney Plied Political Savvy to Lubricate Oil Firms' Deals. And skipping down of some of Dick Cheney's operations when he assumed the head of Halliburton Oil, by the way, Halliburton. February of 1998, Halliburton agrees to buy Dresser Industries for $7.7 billion in stock. The deal brings together two of the nation's leading oil field services concerns and boosts Halliburton's market share of drilling systems. Also, February of 1999, Halliburton's Brown & Root Services Construction Unit wins contract to begin building support construction facilities for troops in the former Yugoslavia. Now, in the August 2nd, 1992 installment of RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, we took a look at the role of people involved with Brown & Root Construction with the milieu of George Herbert Walker Bush and the assassination of President Kennedy. We should note, as we're about to excerpt the July 26th, 1992 installment of Radio Free America Program 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, that Gerald Ford appointed George Bush director of the CIA. Then again, it was his White House chief of staff, Gerald Ford's White House chief of staff was Dick Cheney. What we're going to do now is to excerpt for the record, Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. This is from the July 26th, 1992 installment of RFA 37. And in turn, we're going to excerpt an article from Covert Action Information Bulletins issue number 41 from the summer of 1992. This is an article by Anthony L. Kimmery, K-I-M-M-E-R-Y, entitled In the Company of Friends. And as we examine the line of succession, listen to the role that the oil industry, which we saw in connection with the Hinckley family and the Bush family, notice the role of the oil industry and the petroleum industry here. And we're going to hear about George Bush's beginnings with the oil industry, that's George Herbert Walker Bush's, which is also, apparently, the beginning of his involvement with the intelligence community. And note that this is an involvement with Dresser Industries, now part of Halliburton Oil. Dick Cheney is the head of Halliburton Oil, and Dick Cheney was Gerald Ford's White House chief of staff, and Gerald Ford appointed George Herbert Walker Bush to be director of the CIA, and then George Herbert Walker Bush, who was in the air over Dallas, Texas when Kennedy was killed and whose name crops up in connection with Kennedy's assassination, then helped to frustrate cooperation between the House Select Committee on Assassination and House Select Committee on Assassinations and the CIA. Bush started his career as a salesman for International Derrick and Equipment Company, IDECO, a subsidiary of Houston-based Dresser Industries. This global engineering and construction conglomerate had routinely served as a CIA cover. Bush's job peddling IDECO's services, including behind the Iron Curtain, was a curious responsibility considering Bush's inexperience in either the oil industry or international relations. Dresser Industries' longtime chairman of the board, Henry Neal Mallon, M-A-L-L-O-N, the, quote, surrogate uncle, unquote, and, quote, father confessor, unquote, to Prescott's children, personally offered Bush the IDECO job. Mallon was a friend to numerous ranking Cold War-era intelligence officials, including Alan Dulles, an OSS veteran and ground floor official of the CIA. Dulles headed the agency from 1953 until 1961, when he was sacked by President Kennedy in the wake of the Bay of Pigs disaster. I would interject, Alan Dulles later served on the Warren Commission, allegedly investigating, in fact covering up, President Kennedy's assassination. Continuing here, Mallon steered prospective candidates for spy work to Dulles and often provided cover employment to CIA operatives. Prescott and Mallon were also Yale classmates and initiates of Skull and Bones, the infamous secret Yale fraternity that was a fertile CIA recruiting ground during the Cold War. George joined Skull and Bones his junior year. Another particularly important operative with whom Mallon was well acquainted would also eventually work with George Bush. George de Morenschild, that's capital D-E, capital M-O-H-R-E-N-S-C-H-I-L-D-T, a Russian count whose family fled Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution, had been part of a spy network Dulles ran inside Hitler's intelligence organization. Take note of that. I would take that with a grain of salt. That may be accurate, but it is a matter of record that George de Morenschild actually worked for Nazi intelligence for a period during World War II. He may have been turned. Keep that in mind. We're going to come back to this later. Following the defeat of Nazi Germany, de Morenschild appears to have been submerged as a deep-cover CIA asset, operating under the guise of a consulting petroleum geologist specializing in making deals between U.S. oil companies and the East Bloc nations, to which he was remarkably well-connected. Mallon personally introduced the count to Bush at about the same time Mallon handed Bush the highly sensitive responsibility of negotiating East Bloc deals. The officials with whom Bush dealt had detailed knowledge of Soviet bloc oil and gas production and exploration and drilling capabilities, as well as strategic exploration and production plans outside the USSR. Bush convivially wheeled and dealt with the communist petroleum experts without the slightest grimace by U.S. authorities. In fact, when a Yugoslavian oil industry official came to the U.S. in 1948 to talk to Dresser Industries, the State Department barely flinched, and he went straight to neophyte salesman George Bush in Midland, Texas. Driven by a Cold War policy of covertly thwarting expansion of the Soviet petroleum industry wherever possible, the CIA was desperate for accurate intelligence on the USSR's oil and gas production activities. Quote, "It is inconceivable, then, that the CIA didn't debrief Bush after each and every meeting he had with the East's representatives," unquote, explained Victor Marchetti, a former ranking CIA officer and Soviet specialist during the 1950s. That again from Radio Free America, program number 37, the July 26, 1992 installment. That an excerpt from the article In the Company of Friends by Anthony L. Kimry from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 41. Now, remember that Dresser Industries, George Bush's first petroleum industry employer and probable first intelligence community employer, was now part of Halliburton Oil, and Dick Cheney's the head of that. Bear in mind that Gerald Ford appointed George Bush to be Director of Central Intelligence, and in the New York Times from July 25th of the year 2000, remember the following. By age 34, Mr. Cheney was already White House Chief of Staff, helping President Gerald Ford with the difficult transition after the Watergate scandal that drove President Richard M. Nixon from office. And now we're going to review some connections between the assassination of President Kennedy and Watergate. Bear in mind that George Bush helped to frustrate the House Select Committee on Assassinations' cooperation with the Central Intelligence Agency. Bear in mind also that Richard Nixon appointed George Bush to be head of the Republican National Committee during Watergate, and Nixon, who was a Nixon protege, helped to cover up Watergate, just as he helped to cover up the Kennedy assassination, in which he may very well have been involved when he was director of CIA. Well, with Dick Cheney, the former White House Chief of Staff for Gerald Ford, who also had been vice president, having been appointed to that position by Richard Nixon, and who then succeeded Richard Nixon as president and then pardoned Richard Nixon for all of the crimes that he had committed. Bear in mind that Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on 11-22-63, flew out right about the time Kennedy was being killed, and when interviewed by the FBI said he'd left 2 days earlier. Richard Nixon, by George Herbert Walker Bush's account, was his political mentor. Richard Nixon was also very close to George Herbert Walker Bush's father, Prescott Bush, and bear in mind that White House Chief of Staff Dick Cheney, under Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission, is now the vice presidential selection for George Walker Bush. In a number of different broadcasts, including Guns of November Part 3 and Richard Nixon's Greatest Hits, a miscellaneous archive show, we talked about the many connections between Watergate and the assassination of President Kennedy. Bear in mind that Leon Jaworski, who was White House Chief of Staff, also a member of the MD Anderson Commission, or a member of the Board of Directors, a CIA domestic funding conduit. Leon Jaworski, Watergate Special Prosecutor, had been a Warren Commission counsel and also special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry set up by then-Texas State Attorney General Wagner Carr to investigate the Kennedy assassination. It was Leon Jaworski who was appointed by Richard Nixon to succeed Archibald Cox, President Kennedy's solicitor general, as Watergate Special Prosecutor. And bear in mind also that former White House Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman, that's White House Chief of Staff under Richard Nixon, stated that the whole Bay of Pigs thing was a code word in the Nixon White House for the Kennedy assassination, and it was the whole Bay of Pigs thing which Richard Nixon was afraid would come out if the Watergate cover-up was not properly executed. Bear in mind that, again, Gerald Ford's chief of staff was Dick Cheney. That's why For the Record Program 244 is entitled Line of Succession, Restoring Dignity to the Office of the Presidency. What we're going to take a look at now is the interrogation of Jack Ruby by the Warren Commission. Now, bear in mind as you listen to this reading, which I've engaged in before, that present at the interview of Jack Ruby, who shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, one of whose handlers was George de Morenshield, a white Russian and a former Nazi spy in all probability, who was a close personal friend of George Herbert Walker Bush and whose phone number and address were in George Herbert Walker's address book. Like Bush, de Morenshield was an oil man. Dick Cheney and George Walker Bush are also oil men. But bear in mind now, as you're listening to this interview with Jack Ruby, the people hearing this are Leon Jaworski, again a member of the Board of Directors of the MD Anderson Fund and later Watergate Special Prosecutor, Gerald Ford, at the time House Minority Leader and a member of the Warren Commission, later appointed Vice President by Richard Nixon. He then succeeded Nixon as President and pardoned Richard Nixon. Also present at this particular interview is, of course, Earl Warren, the former Republican vice presidential candidate under Dewey in 1948, when Dewey was running against Harry Truman. And bear in mind also that at present at this same interview are Ruby's attorney Joe Tannehill and also Senator Arlen Specter, Republican senator from Pennsylvania, and the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee that's obstructed Bill Clinton's federal judicial appointments, or obstructed many of them. For those of you who don't think there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, listen to what Jack Ruby had to say in this particular interview. I think it pretty much speaks for itself. We're going to be reading from a book called The Yankee and Cowboy War, subtitled Conspiracies from Dallas to Watergate, authored by Carl Oglesby and published in hardcover by Sheed, Andrews, and McMeel, Incorporated, a subsidiary of Universal Press Syndicate in Kansas City. It's copyright 1976. There's also a softcover edition that is published by Berkeley Medallion Books, also copyrighted 1976. Now, in these excerpts from Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission, or these excerpts, I should say, come from Volume 5 of the Warren Commission's 26 volumes of testimony and exhibits, and they in turn are transcripted from the interview that Jack Ruby had in Dallas, Texas, with the Warren Commission, or representatives of it, from June 7th of 1964. And again, present at this interview are Leon Jaworski, Warren Commission Special Counsel, a member of the M.D. Anderson Fund, CIA Domestic Funding Conduit, and later Watergate Special Prosecutor, Gerald Ford, at the time Warren Commissioner and House Minority Leader, Earl Warren, the former vice presidential candidate under Dewey and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, head of the Warren Commission, Joe Tannehill, Ruby's attorney, whom he doesn't trust, and Senator Arlen Specter, then a Warren Commission counsel, now Republican senator from Pennsylvania. Ruby begins by saying, "Without a lie detector on my testimony, my verbal statements to you, how do you know if I'm telling the truth?" And then Joe Tannehill, his lawyer, says, "Don't worry about that, Jack." And Ruby, "Just a minute, gentlemen. Warren, you wanted to ask something, Mr. Ruby?" Ruby, "I would like to be able to get a lie detector test or truth serum of what motivated me to do what I did at that particular time. And then later, skipping down, Warren. This is another man on my staff, Mr. Spector. Would you mind if he came in? Ruby. Is there any way you can get me to Washington? Warren. I beg your pardon? Ruby. Is there any way of you getting me to Washington? Warren. I don't know of any. I'll be glad to talk to your counsel about what the situation is, Mr. Ruby, when we get an opportunity to talk. Ruby. I don't think I will get a fair representation with my counsel, Joe Tannehill. I don't think so. I would like to request that I go to Washington and you take all the tests that I have to take. It's very important. Tannehill. Jack, will you tell him why you don't think you will get a fair representation? Ruby. Because I've been over this for the longest time to get the lie detector test. Somebody has been holding it back from me. And skipping down. Ruby. Gentlemen, unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me. If you understand my way of talking, you have got to bring me to Washington to get the tests. Do I sound dramatic? Off the beam? Warren. No, you are speaking very, very rationally. And I am really surprised that you can remember as much as you've remembered up to the present time. You have given it to us in great detail. Ruby. Unless you can get me to Washington, and I am not a crackpot, I have all my senses. I don't want to evade any crime I am guilty of. Skipping down, well, it's too bad, Chief Warren, that you didn't get me to your headquarters 6 months ago. And still later, Ruby. Are you staying overnight here, Chief Warren? Warren. No, I have to be back because we have an early session of court tomorrow morning. Ruby. Is there any way of getting the polygraph here? And skipping down. Still Ruby. Gentlemen, if you want to hear any further testimony, you will have to get me to Washington soon because it has something to do with you, Chief Warren. Do I sound sober enough to tell you this? Warren. Yes, go right ahead. Ruby. I want to tell a truth, and I can't tell it here. I can't tell it here. Does that make sense to you? Warren. Well, let's not talk about sense. But I really can't see why you can't tell this commission. Ruby. But this isn't the place for me to tell what I want to tell. Skipping down, and still Ruby here. Chief Warren, your life is in danger in this city. Do you know that? By the way, parenthetically, Earl Warren was a focal point of great hatred by the American right in the 50s and 60s. Continuing, Warren. No, I don't know that. If that's the thing that you don't want to talk about, you can tell me if you wish, when this is all over, just between you and me, Ruby. No, I would like to talk to you in private, Warren. You may do that when you finish your story. You may tell me that phase of it, Ruby. I bet you haven't had a witness like me in your whole investigation. Is that correct, Warren? There are many witnesses whose memory has not been as good as yours. I tell you that honestly, Ruby. My reluctance to talk. You haven't had any witness in telling the story and finding so many problems, Warren. You have a greater problem than any witness we have had, Ruby. I have a lot of reasons for having those problems, Warren. I know that, and we want to respect your rights, whatever they may be. And I only want to hear what you are willing to tell us because I realize that you still have a great problem before you, and I'm not trying to press you. Ruby, when are you going back to Washington? Warren, I'm going back very shortly after we finish this hearing. I'm going to have some lunch. Ruby, can I make a statement? Warren, yes. Ruby, if you request me to go back to Washington with you right now, that couldn't be done, could it? Warren, no, it could not be done. It could not be done. There are a good many things involved in that, Mr. Ruby. Ruby, what are they? Warren, well, the public attention that it would attract and the people who would be around. We have no place for you to be safe when we take you out, and we are not law enforcement officers, and it isn't our responsibility to go into anything of that kind, and certainly it couldn't be done on a moment's notice this way. Ruby, gentlemen, my life is in danger here. Not with my guilty plea of execution, i.e. not because of killing Oswald. Do I sound sober enough to you as I say this? Warren, you do. You sound entirely sober. Ruby, From the moment I started my testimony, have I sounded as though, with the exception of becoming emotional, haven't I sounded as though I made sense what I was speaking about, Warren? You have indeed. I understand everything you have said. If I haven't, it's my fault, Ruby. Then I follow this up. I may not live tomorrow to give any further testimony. The reason why I add this to this, since you assure me that I have been making sense by then, I might be speaking sense by following what I have said, and the only thing I want to get out to the public, and I can't say it here, is with authenticity, with sincerity of the truth of everything, and why my act was committed, but it can't be said here. It can be said, it's got to be said amongst people of the highest authority that would give me the benefit of the doubt. And following that, immediately give me the lie detector test after I do make the statement. Chairman Warren, if you felt that your life was in danger at the moment, how would you feel? Wouldn't you be reluctant to go on speaking, even though you request me to do so, Warren? I think I might have some reluctance if I was in your position. Yes, I think I would. I think I would figure it out very carefully as to whether it would endanger me or not. If you think that anything that I am doing or anything that I am asking you is endangering you in any way, shape, or form, I want you to feel absolutely free to say that the interview is over. Ruby, what happens then? I don't accomplish anything. Warren, no, nothing's been accomplished. Ruby, well, then you won't follow up with anything further? Warren, there wouldn't be anything to follow up if you hadn't completed your statement. Ruby, you said you have the power to do what you want to do. Is that correct? Warren, exactly. Ruby, without any limitations? Warren, within the purview of the executive order that established the commission. Ruby, but you don't have a right to take a prisoner back with you when you want to? Warren, no, we have the power to subpoena witnesses to Washington if we want to do it, but we have taken the testimony of 200 or 300 people, I would imagine, here in Dallas, without going to Washington. Ruby, yes, but those people aren't Jack Ruby. Warren, no, they weren't. Ruby, they weren't. Warren, now I want you to feel that we are not here to take any advantage of you, because I know that you were in a delicate position, and unless you had indicated not only through your lawyers, but also through your sister, who wrote a letter addressed either to me or to Mr. Rankin, saying that you wanted to testify before the commission, unless she had told us that, I wouldn't have bothered you. Ruby, the thing is that with your power that you have, Chief Justice Warren, and all these gentlemen, too much time has gone by for me to give you any benefit of what I may say now. And skipping down, Commission Counsel J. Lee Rankin, who was also present at this testimony, comments. Rankin, it isn't entirely clear how you feel that your family and you yourself are threatened by your telling what you have to the commission. How do you come to the conclusion that they might be killed? Will you tell us a little bit more about that, if you can? Ruby, well, assuming that, as I stated before, some persons are accusing me falsely of being part of the plot. Rankin, by that you mean a party of the plot of Oswald? Ruby, that I was party to a plot to silence Oswald. And skipping down, Warren, Mr. Ruby, I think you are entitled to a statement to this effect, because you've been frank with us and have told us your story. I think I can say to you that there has been no witness before this commission out of the hundreds we have questioned who has claimed to have any personal knowledge that you were part of a party to any conspiracy to kill our president. Ruby, yes, but you don't know this area here. Warren, well, I will make this additional statement to you, that if any witness should testify before the commission that you were, to their knowledge, a party to any conspiracy to assassinate the president, I assure you that we will give you the opportunity to deny it and to take any tests that you may desire to so disprove it. Skipping down, Ruby, and I wish that our beloved President Lyndon Johnson would have delved deeper into the situation, hear me, not to accept just circumstantial facts about my guilt or innocence, and would have questioned to find out the truth about me before he relinquished certain powers to these certain people. Consequently, a whole new form of government is going to take over our country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. Do I sound sort of screwy in telling you these things, Warren? No, I think that is what you believe, or you wouldn't tell it under oath, Ruby, but this is a very serious situation. I guess it's too late to stop it, isn't it? And skipping down, House Minority Leader and Warren Commission member Gerald Ford asks the next question. Ford, are there any questions that ought to be asked to help clarify the situation that you describe? Ruby, there is only one thing. If you don't take me back to Washington tonight to give me a chance to prove to the president that I am not guilty, then you will see the most tragic thing that will ever happen. And skipping down, Ruby, now maybe something can be saved. It may not be too late, whatever happens, if our president Lyndon Johnson knew the truth from me. But if I'm eliminated, there won't be any way of knowing. Right now, when I leave your presence now, I am the only one that can bring out the truth to our president who believes in righteousness and justice. But he has been told, I'm certain, that I was part of a plot to assassinate the president. I know, your hands are tied, you're helpless. And Warren then says, Mr. Ruby, I think I can say this to you, that if he has been told any such thing, there's no indication of any kind that he believes it. Skipping down. Ruby, no, the only way you can do it is if he knows the truth, that I am telling the truth, and why I was down in that basement Sunday morning. Skipping down. Warren, the president will know everything that you have said. Everything that you've said. Ruby, but I won't be around, Chief Justice. I won't be around to verify those things that you're going to tell the president. Tannehill, who never left the room. Who do you think is going to eliminate you, Jack? Ruby, I have been used for a purpose, and there will be a certain tragic occurrence happening if you don't take my testimony and somehow vindicate me, Warren. But we have taken your testimony. We have it here. It will be in permanent form for the President of the United States, and for the Congress of the United States, and for the courts of the United States, and for the people of the entire world. It's there. It will be recorded for all to see. That is the purpose of our coming here today. We feel that you are entitled to have your story told. Ruby, you have lost me, though. You've lost me, Chief Justice Warren. Warren, lost you in what sense? Ruby, I won't be around for you to come and question again. Warren, well, it's very hard for me to believe that. I am sure that everybody would want to protect you to the very limit. Ruby, all I want is a lie detector test, and you refuse to give it to me, because as it stands now in the truth serum and any other pentothal, how do you pronounce it, whatever it is, and they will not give it to me, because I want to tell the truth. We've been reading From the Yankee and Cowboy War by Carl Oglesby, and in turn, those excerpts of Jack Ruby's Warren Commission testimony are from Volume 5, pages 181 through 212. And again, among the people present, were Gerald Ford and Arlen Specter, as well as Watergate Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski. And bear in mind the line of succession and how the Georges Bush and the milieu of which they are a part, father and son, have restored dignity to the office of the presidency. This concludes For the Record Program 244, Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 5, Line of Succession, Restoring Dignity to the Office of the Presidency. This is being recorded on August 13th of the year 2000. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.